From a man whose method of determining who to send Christmas cards to resembles the Alcoholics Anonymous protocol of going back to apologize to people whom they wronged years before, this is the Daniel and Natal Show. In the year 2000, of the top 100 economies in the world, 51 were corporations. In 2022, it's now up to 69. A company like Apple, with assets upwards of $3 trillion, has more of a GDP than the United Kingdom, India, France, Italy, Canada, and South Korea. A company like BlackRock, which now controls $10 trillion in assets, is richer than every nation on Earth but two, the United States and China. What does this mean as corporations become richer and more powerful than nation-states? More than a century ago, steel magnate Andrew Carnegie became very good at creating a monopoly. He'd undercut smaller companies, put out steel for cheaper than they could produce it, even if he was doing it at a loss. When other companies couldn't match these cut-rate prices, they'd go bankrupt, whereupon Carnegie would buy them up for pennies on the dollar and then jack the prices back up. I was watching this one video on him, and the naive narrator said, "But oddly, for so ruthless a robber baron, he seemed to have a softer side. He created the Carnegie Institute for Peace, where he tried to foster international understanding." What the person who created the video didn't understand was that the same techniques Carnegie brought to business, he applied to the nation-state model. You sabotage and undercut individual countries, and then you can absorb their remains into one larger world monopoly. So basically, what we call globalism today is the technique of monopoly as applied to nation-states. What Carnegie envisioned was a one-world corporatocracy, where pesky countries and political systems couldn't get in the way of corporate control. As the corporations rose in power, you saw a corresponding diminution in the power of the nation-state. See Eric Lee talk about China versus the United States with respect to this process.
There are a lot of problems, but at the moment, the Chinese, the party state, has proven an extraordinary ability to change. I mean, I make the joke how in America, you can change political parties, but you can't change the policies. In China, you cannot change the party, but you can change policies. So in the 65 or 66 years, China's being run by one single party, yet the political changes that have taken place in China in this past 66 years have been wider and broader and greater than probably any other major country in modern memory.
So in that time, China ceased to be communist. Is that what you're saying?
Well, China is a market economy, and it's a vibrant market economy, but it is not a capitalist country. Here's why. There's no way a group of billionaires could control the Politburo, as billionaires control American policymaking. So in China, you have a vibrant market economy, but capital does not rise above political authority. Capital does not have enshrined rights. In America, capital, the interest of capital and capital itself has risen above the American nation. The political authority cannot check the power of capital. And that's why America is a capitalist country, but China is not.
So a strange process is underway right now, whereby power and sovereignty are being transferred from ordinary people and their political systems to corporations. In the 20th century, after World War II, one global economic grid was set up under the Bretton Woods system established in 1944. Hear geopolitical strategist Peter Zion talk about it here.
At the end of World War II, the United States was really the last man standing. So we drew our allies together and pitched an idea for a new age. We will guard all civilian trade everywhere in the world. And in exchange, we get to write your security policies. We bribed up an alliance to fight the Cold War, and it worked. But the Cold War ended 30 years ago, and the question now is, what's next? Well, if you want to maintain a global order, if you want to maintain a global system, global peace, you have to do one of three things. Well, actually, you do three of three things. Number one, you have to have a political culture that agrees that a global system is a good idea. I would argue that that was already on the rocks well before Donald Trump ever entered the White House. And with the events of January 6th, I would argue that our political culture needs time to heal, and that will take time. I mean, let's assume for just a second that Joe Biden is the guy, and he will be able to magically bring us all together and into a new age of American leadership. How long do you think that's going to take? Like an hour? 6 months? 2 years? More time than he has? This is what, year and a half? It's going to take time. In the meantime, no one's managing the global system. Okay, so if we don't have the political culture, what else? Number two, global interests. Well, we've never had that. As a percentage of GDP, the United States remains the least involved economy in the world. For us, globalization was a means to a security end. We pay you to stand with us against the Soviets. We never invested our economy in it because then it wouldn't have been a bribe. It would have been extortion. So, one and two, both gone. What's the third one? You want to maintain a global system, you need a global military footprint, and that's gone. This is total U.S. troop deployments around the world year by year. We now have fewer troops stationed around the world than at any time since the 1920s. Folks, it's over. And if you're betting on globalized exchange for anything in your life, you should be prepared to write it off.
Here's the thing. The Bretton Woods trade network that a nation-state built at the end of World War II is what made globalization possible for corporations. They became dependent on it as sources for raw materials and cheap labor. As the United States starts to withdraw from it, a push is being made by the corporatocracy to keep it going, but under new management. Historian Peter Turchin says that one critical component of empire, what he calls a cooperation zone, is a unifying ideology. An ideology is the only thing that can overcome differences in race, language, heritage, and so forth. That's why you didn't really see the rise of big empires before the Axial Age, where the great world religion started. Of course, as Turchin points out, the unifying ideology doesn't have to be a religion. The Roman Empire, for instance, had Stoic philosophy. The point is that you need a unifying belief structure to make a cooperation zone possible. In the Bretton Woods period after World War II, it was Americanism, democracy. Places all around the world reacted to the soft power of the United States, like Iran having women in miniskirts or people in Albania buying rock and roll albums. You had countries all around the world trying to emulate America's political system. As the Bretton Woods system is starting to fall apart, the appeal of Americanism is going somewhat sour. The corporations who want to keep the global grid going to maintain their supply chains have so far faltered in their response to a unifying belief system. In the power vacuum created by the collapse of a belief in Americanism, the best that they came up with is what Larry Fink of BlackRock is calling ESG. We did a previous report on this. Conservatives love to joke about companies that virtue signal and lose money, like KFC with its tone-deaf BLM pandering, or Target losing $1 billion after adopting their position on transgender bathrooms. The cliche is, get woke, go broke. But this is exactly the opposite of why the largest corporations are doing this. In reality, they went broke, and then they got woke. Let me explain. In 2008, we experienced an economic catastrophe worse than the Great Depression due to subprime mortgages. In many ways, we still never recovered from it. Trillions of dollars of wealth evaporated overnight. Many banks and corporations lost their shirts. In the wake of this economic tsunami, corporate debt swelled, but nobody wanted to buy their bonds to help them out. Enter government bailouts. Ironically, the United States tapped a private sector individual named Larry Fink, the founder of BlackRock, to use money from the Treasury to buy back these toxic bonds to keep these businesses on life support. Why I said ironically is that Larry Fink was one of the inventors of the concept of debt securitization, which was a method used to hide risk that led to the subprime housing crisis in the first place. So basically, they hired the man who helped cause the meltdown to allay the damage from the aftermath, kind of like the fire department hiring the arsonist who caused the fire to put the fire out. At any rate, Larry Fink and BlackRock started to buy back these corporate bonds to give these flailing companies an infusion of cash to keep them on life support, but he attached strings. Any company that didn't go woke, he said, wouldn't get cash. Fink calls his woke program ESG. It stands for Environmental, Social, and Governance. It's a system by which companies reorganize themselves internally and reorient themselves towards supporting the woke ideology. See here.
So where does BlackRock go moving forward? What does a man do when he already has everything? In 2019, people were petitioning against BlackRock for being among the top shareholders for oil and coal production. In fact, investing in heavy pollution industries has basically been the backbone of BlackRock's portfolio over the years. So according to Larry, they're making a push towards environmental, social, and sustainable investing. Whether or not they actually believe in this stuff is yet to be known. Nevertheless, it does appear they've made legit efforts to expand into this more eco-friendly market. With new environmentally focused products, they've partnered with activist investors, they backed a shareholder resolution basically forcing ExxonMobil to get serious about climate change. Larry even straight up wrote a letter telling companies that they need to, quote, contribute to society to receive his firm's support. This new push for sustainable investing or ESG investing is a big reason why you see so many corporations trying to appear woke these days.
If you want to invest in a company, they will, on their investor relations page, they'll show you their ESG score. ESG stands for Environmental, Social, Corporate Governance. And this is where the woke culture comes from. So they've created this kind of phony baloney rating system that says, well, if you, I'm exaggerating, but if you mention that you are, you know, have a green agenda and you believe in carbon credits and you might trade some credit somewhere, then you get a higher score and therefore you're more investable. And it's very interesting to see how big investors like insurance company, institutional investors, they are steering away from anything that does not have the right ESG rating. And so in order to have investors continue to be interested in the stock, which is important for the company, for its perception, certainly for the officers of the company and the shareholders, you have to move this along continuously. And so it's very simple to see why doing a woke ad as Nike or as any other company, Pride Month is fantastic, because you could, I mean, Pride is easy. Throw up some flags, show the right people, trans, right, whatever, right, and you got a high ESG score.
It's questionable as to whether countries around the world will latch on to the new unifying global ideology that BlackRock is proposing. Places like India, for instance, are rejecting what they perceive as nihilistic philosophies with slogans like modernization yes, westernization no. China has already signaled that it has no interest in eradicating their own culture for woke culture and disadvantaging their own citizens in the name of diversity, as ESG demands. Here's the thing. Can a global grid keep operating in the absence of unifying planetary ideology? Peter Turchin says no. If the corporations had adopted ethics as their global ideology, it might have been workable. According to Cesar Hidalgo of the MIT Media Lab, they did an analysis of history's most famous people. With their computer program called Pantheon, they analyzed all books, manuscripts, and literary materials from across the globe from 4000 BC to the present. The top three most famous people were Jesus at number three, Plato at number two, and the top spot going to Aristotle. Leaving aside the divisive potential of religion, if the corporations wanted to promote an ideology that almost everyone around the world respects, they would have done better to advance the teachings of Aristotle and Plato. They would have been wise to promote ethics as unifying world culture. Instead, they went with ESG and woke culture. We'll soon find out if that'll be the magic bullet that BlackRock is banking on. Straight from the New American Magazine, the essential news source for freedom-loving Americans, we bring you Beyond the Cover. We're influential contributors to the magazine's print edition. Join host Gary Benoit to discuss their articles, often offering important insights not found in the articles themselves. Head to thenewamerican.com to learn more.